those who practice Judaism, but those of Jewish blood, regardless of their assimilation into marriage, religious activity, or even conversion to Christianity. Only after Jews were identified could they be targeted for asset confiscation, ghettoization, deportation, and ultimately, extermination. To search generations of communal church and governmental records all across Germany and later throughout Europe was a cross-indexing task so monumental it called for a computer. But in 1933, no computer existed. When the Reich needed to mount a systematic campaign of Jewish economic disenfranchisement, and later began the massive movement of European Jews out of their homes and into ghettos, once again, the task was so prodigious, it called for a computer. But in 1933, no computer existed. When the final solution sought to efficiently transport Jews out of European ghettos along railroad lines and into death camps with timing so precise the victims were able to walk right out of the boxcar and into a waiting gas chamber, the coordination was so complex a task, this too called for a computer. But in 1933, no computer existed. However, another invention did exist. The IBM punch card and card sorting system, a precursor to the computer. IBM, primarily through its German subsidiary, made Hitler's program of Jewish destruction a technologic mission the company pursued with chilling success. IBM Germany, using its own staff and equipment, designed, executed, and supplied the indispensable technological assistance Hitler's Third Reich needed to accomplish what had never been done before, the automation of human destruction. More than 2,000 such multi-machine sets were dispatched throughout Germany and thousands more throughout Nazi-dominated Europe. Card sorting operations were established in every major concentration camp. People were moved from place to place, systematically worked to death, and their remains cataloged with icy automation. IBM Germany, known in those days as Deutsche Hallerith Maschinengesellschaft, or DEHOMAG, did not simply sell the Reich machines and then walk away. IBM's subsidiary, with the knowledge of its New York headquarters, enthusiastically custom-designed the complex devices and specialized applications as an official corporate undertaking. DEHOMAG's top management was comprised of openly rabid Nazis who were arrested after the war for their party affiliation. IBM New York always understood, from the outset in 1933, that it was courting and doing business with the upper echelon of the Nazi Party. Indeed, the company leveraged its Nazi Party connections to continuously enhance its business relationship with Hitler's Reich in Germany and throughout Nazi-dominated Europe. DEHOMAG and other IBM subsidiaries custom-designed the applications. Its technicians sent mock-ups of punch cards back and forth to Reich offices until the data columns were acceptable, much as any software engineer would do today. Punch cards could only be designed, printed, and purchased from one source, IBM. The machines were not sold, they were leased, and regularly maintained and upgraded by only one source, IBM. IBM subsidiaries trained the Nazi officers and their surrogates throughout Europe, set up branch offices and local dealerships throughout Nazi Europe, staffed by a revolving door of IBM employees, and scoured paper mills to produce as many as 1.5 billion punch cards per year in Germany alone. Moreover, the fragile machines were serviced on site about once per month, even when that site was in or near a concentration camp. I have long been haunted by a question whose answer has long eluded historians. The Germans always had the lists of Jewish names. Suddenly, a squadron of grim-faced SS would burst into a city square and post a notice demanding those listed assemble the next day at the train station for deportation to the east. But how did the Nazis get the lists? For decades, no one has known. few have even asked.
The answer? IBM Germany's census operations and similar advanced people counting and registration technologies. IBM was founded in 1896 by German inventor Hermann Hollerith as a census tabulating company. Census was its business. But when IBM Germany formed its philosophical and technological alliance with Nazi Germany, census and registration took on a new mission. IBM Germany virtually invented the racial census, listing not just religious affiliation, but bloodline, going back generations. This was the Nazi data lust, not just to count the Jews, but to identify them. How much did IBM know? Some of it, IBM knew on a daily basis throughout the 12-year Reich. The worst of it, IBM preferred not to know. Don't ask, don't tell was the order of the day. Yet IBM New York officials, and frequently Watson's personal representatives, Harrison Chauncey and Werner Lear, were almost constantly in Berlin or Geneva, monitoring activities, ensuring that the parent company in New York was not cut out of any of the profits or business opportunities Nazism presented. When U.S. law made such direct contact illegal, IBM's Swiss office became the nexus, providing the New York office continuous information and credible deniability. What made me demand answers to the unasked questions about IBM and the Holocaust? I confronted the reality of IBM's involvement one day in 1993 in Washington at the United States Holocaust Museum. There, in the very first exhibit, an IBM Hollerith D11 card sorting machine, riddled with circuits, slots, and wires, was prominently displayed. Clearly affixed to the machine's front panel, glistened an IBM nameplate. The exhibit explained little more than that IBM was responsible for organizing the German census of 1933 that first identified the Jews. IBM had been tight-lipped about its involvement with Nazi Germany. So although 15 million people, including most major Holocaust experts, have seen the display, and in spite of the best efforts of leading museum historians, little more was understood about this provocative display other than the brief curator's description at the exhibit and a few pages of supportive research. I still remember staring at the machine for an hour, and the moment when I turned to my mother and father, who accompanied me to the museum that day, and promised them I would discover more. My parents are Holocaust survivors, uprooted from their homes in Poland. My mother escaped from a boxcar en route to Treblinka, was shot and then buried in a shallow mass grave. My father had already run away from a guarded line of Jews and discovered her leg protruding from the snow. By moonlight and by courage, these two teenagers survived against the cold, the hunger, and the Reich. Standing next to me 5 decades later, their image within the reflection of the exhibit glass, shrapnel and bullet fragments permanently embedded in their bodies, my parents could only express confusion. For my sake, I had questions. The Nazis had my parents' names. How? What was the connection of this gleaming black, beige, and silver machine squatting silently in this dimly lit museum to the millions of Jews and other Europeans who were murdered? And murdered not just in a chaotic split second as a casualty of war, but in a grotesque and protracted 12-year campaign of highly organized humiliation, dehumanization, and then ultimately, extermination. For years after that chance discovery in the museum, I was shadowed by the realization that IBM was somehow involved in the Holocaust in technologic ways that had not yet been pieced together. Dots were everywhere. Those dots needed to be connected. Knowing that International Business Machines has always billed itself as a solutions company, I understood that IBM does not merely wait for governmental customers to call. IBM has amassed its fortune and reputation precisely because it generally anticipates governmental and corporate needs even before they develop. and then offers designs and delivers customized solutions, even if it must execute those technologic solutions with its own staff and equipment. IBM has done so for countless government agencies, corporate giants, and industrial associations. For years, I promised myself I would one day answer the question, how many solutions did IBM provide to Nazi Germany? I knew about the initial solution, the census. Just how far did the solutions go? In 1998, I began an obsessive quest for answers. Proceeding without any foundation funds, organizational grants, or publisher dollars behind me, I began recruiting a team of researchers, interns, translators, and assistants, all on my own dime. Soon a network developed throughout the United States, as well as in Germany, Israel, England, Holland, Poland, and France. This network continued to grow as time went on. Holocaust survivors, children of survivors, retirees and students with no connection to the Holocaust, as well as professional researchers, distinguished archivists and historians, and even former Nuremberg trial investigators, all began a search for documentation. Ultimately, more than 100 people participated, some for months, some for just a few hours at a time. Most of my team was volunteers, all of them sworn to secrecy. Each was shocked and saddened by the implications of the project and intensely motivated. A few said they could not sleep well for days after learning of the IBM connection. In my darkest moments, I was often sustained by their words of encouragement. Ultimately, I assembled more than 20,000 pages of documentation from 50 archives, library manuscript collections, museum files, and other repositories. None of the 20,000 documents were flashcards. It was much more complex. Examined singly, none revealed their story. Indeed, most of them were profoundly misleading as standalone papers. They only assumed their true meaning when juxtaposed with numerous other related documents, often from totally unrelated sources. In other words, the documents were all puzzle pieces. The picture could not be constructed until all the fragments were put together. In the truest sense, the story of IBM and the Holocaust has been shattered into thousands of shards. Only by piecing them all together did I erect a towering picture window permitting me to view what really occurred. That verified account is retold in this book. In my pursuit, I received extraordinary cooperation from every public, private, and governmental source in every country. Sadly, the only refusal came from IBM itself, which rebuffed my request for access to documents and interviews. I was not alone. Since World War II, the company has steadfastly refused to cooperate with outside authors. Virtually every recent book on IBM, whether written by esteemed business historians or ex-IBM employees, includes a reference to the company's refusal to cooperate with the author in any way. Ultimately, I was nonetheless able to arrange proper access. Hundreds of IBM documents were placed at my disposal. I read them all. In reconstructing the facts, I was guided on every page by two principles, context and consequences. For instance, although I enjoyed access to volumes of diplomatic and intelligence information, I was careful to concentrate on what was known publicly in the media about atrocities and anti-Jewish conditions in Europe. For this reason, you will notice an extraordinary reliance on articles in the New York Times. I quote the New York Times not because it was the newspaper of record in America, but because IBM executives, including Thomas Watson, were headquartered in New York. Had they lived in Chicago, I would have quoted the Chicago Tribune. Had they lived in Cleveland, I would have quoted the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Many of us have become enraptured in the age of computerization and the age of information. I know I have. But now, I am consumed with a new awareness that for me as the son of Holocaust survivors brings me to a whole new consciousness. I call it the age of realization as we look back and examine technology's wake. Unless we understand how the Nazis acquired the names, more lists will be compiled against more people.